Thanks for staying. Folks, hopefully you've enjoyed the Panama Papers. We're very lucky. We have Colm Keenan, the legal affairs correspondent from the Irish Times, who worked extensively on the Panama Papers. Colm has worked with the ICIJ for the International Confederation of Investigative Journalists for many years. So we're very lucky to have Colm here. Colm, thanks for coming. Can everybody hear us? Is yours on, Colm? Yeah. Can everybody hear Colm? No. Wait a see. We'll get there now.
Hello. One, two.
Brilliant. Colm, again, thanks for coming. Tell us how you got involved with the ICIJ and with the Panama Papers.
Sure. Well, actually, it's Jared Ryle there, who's the founder of the ICIJ, is originally from Kerry, worked in the Irish press back in the day, as I did as well. And he met the Irish Times Washington correspondent, Simon Carswell, over in Washington after one of their earliest projects. So the next one they did then was, I think, Swiss Leaks, which was about a leak from a Swiss bank, HSBC. And so I got involved at that stage. I worked on that project. Then I worked on LuxLeaks, which was about corporate tax avoidance using Luxembourg. And then the next one was Panama Papers.
Yeah. And how long was this in investigation? If anybody's a journalist here, they know that just how hard it is to get any time on a story. So how long were you able to?
I was very lucky. The paper, the Irish Times, gave me time to work on the project.
Yeah.
But this was, I think, maybe the biggest leak ever. And a fellow from the one of the science magazines worked out that if all the pages that were leaked were put one on top of the other, they'd be 41 miles high.
Yeah.
So you got access over the internet to the data bank, and you also had access over the internet with a kind of our own little social media thing, and we could talk to each other. So if I happened upon a mention of a Canadian man that was a politician or whatever, then I could contact a guy in Canada and say, I've come across this, you might be interested, and likewise back. Yeah. And so we could cooperate like that.
Yeah. Who was for the audience, just the local, the Irish connection, who was Frank Flannery?
Yeah, the big story we went on the first day was I came across the name Frank Flannery. He was a long-term advisor to Enda Kenny at the Fine Gael party. And he'd been the chief executive of Rehab, the organization for disabled people, support services. But at one stage, he'd moved over to the UK to set up the rehab operation there. And he bought a very nice house in London. And the files showed that he had got a 100% mortgage from the Bank of Ireland to buy the house. But the bank knew that there was a company that had 290 or 300,000 pounds offshore in Jersey, and that money was being used to support the mortgage, which was in and around the same amount of money. This was back in the 1990s. So the name, I can't remember the name of the company, offshore company, but it had something to do with charity. So there was this offshore company that was used to back the purchase of the house by Mr. Flannery in London. And the strange thing about it was you could see from the files that the Bank of Ireland knew this and knew and agreed to the deal, and the name of the deputy manager, I think, of the bank in Jersey, the Bank of Ireland in Jersey, was writing letters to Mossack Fonseca, and it was all sort of organized. It was perfectly obvious that it was being done to conceal money, and why it was being done, I still don't know. Mr. Flannery never explained it. But I think he then resigned as advisor to the Taoiseach and to Fine Gael.
And Colm, what was Intertrade?
Oh, yeah. So another biggish story we did was I looked at it's an Irish company that's just a name, really, a registered name. And it was an Irish company that had nominee directors in Dublin, and in fact was run out of a house about half a mile away from where I live in Drumcondra in Dublin. So it was one of these company formations businesses where they establish companies and sell them on to people then, and you can do whatever you want. But this company had nominee directors, if I remember correctly, people in Ireland acting as its shareholders and directors and company secretaries and so on. But the people behind it were, in fact, an Italian man who lived in Manila and an American woman, a solicitor who worked in Greece. And they had, in turn, Intertrade had been a party to contracts between an Italian armaments company, a really huge company. British Aerospace had a percentage in it. They sold, war planes, bombs, submarines, stuff like that. So they major contracts with the government in the Philippines and the government in India. And this Irish company was then a party to what's called sub-agency agreements, where in return for getting these contracts signed, there were commission payments paid. And this is something that's common enough in the armaments industry and is frowned upon because it's sometimes evidence of corruption and under-the-table payments. And so in that instance, I worked closely with a journalist in India. She was interested because the Indian government had bought armaments from the Italian armaments company and tanks, I think, and missiles. And then the Irish company was party to these sub-agency agreements. And there were names in the mix there that included an Indian man who'd been jailed for corruption in the United States. So it was quite a good global corruption story.
This was all come from the Panama Papers at a nondescript house in Drumcondra, but everything, the web was going
around and the world. It's a bit like the woman you saw there who was a secretary of thousands of companies and she lived in a small house in Panama City. You know, I'm not suggesting that the men in Drumcondra knew what the company was doing, but it's part of this whole offshore global thing where a lot of the people involved don't know what's happening, but yet they're processing all these transactions.
Yeah. Journalists were incredibly secretive and protective, and we have our own egos and everything else. How hard was it to work with, maybe 300 and more than 300 journalists all around the world, and for this to keep this story for a year and until the 3rd of April 2016, nothing broke.
Well, two things struck me about it. Is that I'm a print journalist, so I go along and I do my research and write my story, whereas there were TV crews involved in this business. So they do their research, get their story, then they start filming, editing, writing script. And so they'd be ready to write their story about 6 months before they're ready to broadcast the story. I found that really frustrating. So I worked on these stories and then sort of parked them, because you can't go to people and say, can I get a response until a week before publication date. So I'd have to put everything in the drawer and just leave it there for a few months while the TV companies were off doing their edits and so on. But in terms of keeping your mouth shut, obviously that's something a journalist has to do on a kind of an ongoing basis. And in terms of being competitive, I always want to publish the story as quickly as possible in case a competitor gets the story. But in this instance, you had to play ball with everybody, because Gerald and the rest of the people in the ICIJ, I mean, you get thrown out pretty quickly. You know, if you blew a big project like this, it would, just be so embarrassed, and you wouldn't be asked back the next time around.
The nuts and bolts of it. Where did you meet?
I've been involved in a few of them now. Usually, you go to the country of the person who got the leak. So in this instance, we went to the offices of Süddeutsche Zeitung, and I think we saw it in the film there. And it's a big, tall skyscraper, and they've got three floors in the building that are dedicated to investigative journalism.
Right.
You know, and the Irish Times, I did it as a part time as well as other jobs. You know, but so it's interesting to see a very well resourced organization like that, and they managed to keep it secret from the rest of the people in Süddeutsche Zeitung. So only a small number of people were allowed to get off of the floor in the building where they were working.
The Revenue Commission in Dublin in the south, they tried to get, tried to force the Irish Times to hand over the Panama Papers or what the stuff that you have been given.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, they sent us letters looking for the documentation concerned Irish people or Irish companies. I think you mentioned 300. I can't remember. There was a number of hundreds such companies and people in the documentation and included, very rich people in Irish society who you wouldn't be surprised to have offshore accounts and offshore companies and who might not be tax resident here. And one of the issues you have to decide on when you're working on a story like this as a reporter is, you're invading people's privacy, you got access to their highly confidential documentation about their affairs. Is there public interest or justification for writing about them? And then you have the Revenue coming and saying, can we have all the documents you have? So we just said no. And it was kind of an easy one because the documents belong to the ICIJ or Süddeutsche Zeitung, really, are the two of them between them. So I just shredded any paper ones I have. And otherwise, it's all, you know, on the end, it's all in servers somewhere in the world, and I don't know where the servers are. So
you were in the early 2000s, you were involved in a story which led to the resignation of Bertie Ahern, and there was another case of destroying notes to protect sources. Can you tell people about that?
Yeah, sure. So I got some documents. And we were able to write a story about the fact that a planning corruption tribunal was investigating payments that had been made to Bertie Ahern by a number of business people. What was interesting about the story was it wasn't an allegation that the payments had been made. It was accepted that the payments had been made. The documents showed that the payments had been made and that it was accepted that they'd be made. So it caused quite a crisis. And actually, it's kind of slightly amusing and maybe relevant to the situation Barry's been in recently. But before that, I'd covered a tribunal involving Charlie Haughey and offshore in the Cayman Islands. He had money in these things called the Anspacher deposits, and he used to get payments via the Cayman Islands. But he had a very loyal and a very bright secretary, worked with him for a long time in Leinster House. And she had a diary where she kept the record of everything. And when this tribunal was established, she was following the evidence as it was relayed in the media. And she realised they're going to come to me and they're going to ask for any documents I have. So she went out and shredded her diaries. And that was a perfectly legal thing to do. She was eventually called to give evidence and made a point that got the judge to agree in public and have it go on the public record that she was perfectly entitled to shred the documents because she hadn't actually been asked for them at the time she shredded them. That thought crossed my mind as I was leaving the office after I'd written the story about Bertie Ahern. Myself and the editor of the paper, we didn't really understand it was going to cause such a huge fuss. But it caused complete meltdown in the government at the time. And the following week, then, we got a legal order from the tribunal to produce all the documentation that we had because they were entitled to do that. And they were entitled to issue that order. So we discussed it in the office, and then we shredded the documents.
And were they trying to look for the whistleblower, or...?
They were trying to find the source of the information, and they wanted to have a look at the documents. And I found out later, then we were called to give evidence at the tribunal, and some of the documentation, they knew what documents they were, and they would have file copies in their office, and they would have other copies that they'd sent out to people, and the copies that were sent out would have been signed, but the ones that were kept in the office would have been unsigned. So if we had handed over the documents, they would have been able to immediately see whether the documents came from the tribunal or member staff in the tribunal or somebody that they'd sent the documents out to. And in each case, that would be a very small number of people. And the thinking that was going through our minds in when we shredded the documents was that there had been a case involving the Guardian years previously where a woman in the Department of Defence sent documents into the Guardian to do with the nuclear missiles that were being in Green and Common, and she was of the view that the public were being misled about nuclear missiles in Green and Common, and she sent documents in anonymously to the Guardian. They ran the story. The editor was then served with an order, and he handed over the documents. And what he didn't realise was the documents had been photocopied with inside the Department of Defence, and every time you photocopied a document, there was a little code up the top of the page, like the kind of thing you wouldn't notice. So they were able to identify exactly what photocopier it had been had been copied on, and then that narrowed it down to a small group of people. So the woman who'd done it then fessed up because she didn't want her colleagues to get in trouble for something she'd done, and she went to jail. So the editor of the Guardian resigned as a result. So we were very conscious of that, and that's why we shredded the documents.
And what impact do you think that the Panama Papers actually had? You know, tax evasion a victimless crime? You know, did the ordinary person in the street care?
I mean, I think, as I said, it's a story I've been working on since, you know, Charlie Haughey and the McCracken Tribunal in 1997. I've worked in the business section of the paper for a long time, and I cover a lot of very rich people's affairs. They're nearly all offshore. And a good few years ago, there was a debate in the Department of Finance about whether there should be a minimum income tax. So let's say income tax at the time was the mid-40s or whatever. And they said, well, let's say no matter what scheme you're part of, you have to pay 30%. And then they decided that that's a bad idea, because if you do that, everybody who's rich will go into their accountants and say, why am I paying 32%? You know, and sack them and get it. And some rich people were paying 35% or whatever. So, I mean, the richest people pay the least tax proportionate to their income. One of the things that struck me about the Panama Papers was I did a story about a guy called Paddy from Cavan who emailed the Mossack Fonseca because he came across their name on Google, and he had an idea for setting up a small business and wanted to know if they could set up an offshore tax structure, an offshore trust, all this sort of stuff, so that whatever small business he was running up in County Cavan wouldn't have to pay any tax. And they said, sure. You know, so, you know, it's a case of everybody's doing it. So I don't know who's going to pay for the hospitals. But the other thing about it, there's a very good book I read recently, I'd recommend it, called Moneyland. And by a young English journalist. And I mean, it's causing countries to collapse, because if, you know, if you have a prime minister or, somebody who's got an oligarch or whatever, who's ripping off a country and they're stashing all, they're buying everything in the country and they own everything in the country, everybody in the country will know. And maybe there's a tipping point beyond which it becomes sort of impossible. But in a lot of countries, people are robbing stuff and then it's going offshore. And then they end up buying houses in London and buying apartments in New York. These things are almost becoming money boxes rather than properties. They're ways of stashing stolen money. And then countries are collapsing. And then the people in those countries are coming to Europe and are coming to America. And it's making our politics really toxic. So I'm not saying that's the explanation for everything, but it's a major factor in the nastiness of the world we live in today is offshore.
I don't know who's in charge. Do we do questions, or has anybody got a question for Colm? No, we're out of time. it showed up your question, and that's the last one, and then we'll all head to the bar.
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, I mean, as well as doing all this sort of corrupt stuff, you know, most of this stuff happens in front of your face. So the worst thieves of them all really are Google, Facebook, the pharmacies, the pharmaceutical companies and so on. And they have trillions and trillions of dollars stashed in the offshore world. But funnily enough, the OECD is doing something. And one of the reasons that the Department of Finance in Dublin is concerned at the moment is we have a whole wave of corporation tax coming into the Irish Exchequer at the moment because the people like Facebook and so on are feeling the pressure. And they're moving more stuff onshore and they're moving into places like Ireland where they pay a minimal amount of tax rather than no tax. But because they're such huge companies, it's a kind of a gold rush for the Department of Finance. So things are changing. But the big problem is all of these little offshore places are nation states. So I don't know what you do. Yes. You know?
How does society move on? Are we out of time, or can we take one more question? Or no, we're out of time. Listen, anybody, Colm's gonna be walking about here, so kidnap him. Get him outside. He's a brilliant journalist. He has brought down Taoiseachs and everything else. We're very lucky to have him here. So don't let him go without asking him your question. Yes, that's great. Well, probably in the film, they talked about one of the things that the ICIJ was reeling against was this lone wolf journalism. And the confederation, or the fact that 300 journalists around the world were working together to bring this thing together.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, working in it, the most striking thing about it for me was this topic is a huge topic in every country in the world. Yeah. You know, so you could meet somebody from Brazil or from Lebanon or from, you know, Tunisia, and we all had the same problem, exactly the same problem. Yeah. So it's a globalization story in lots and lots of different ways. Corruption has become a globalized business, but also the concerns of the citizenry all over the globe, exactly the same.
Mm. Right, folks, so we thank Colm Keenan. Okay. And thank you to Docs Ireland. It's the first year. It's fantastic. Thank you. Thanks for coming.